Thank everybody who read. The young man who's going to speak tonight, I had the good fortune of hearing him at my home group a few weeks ago, and I was thinking the literature and the books and all the stuff that we have tell us, you know, how to do AA and how to do recovery, and we can also learn how not to do AA and how not to do recovery. But I'll let Alexander explain that part of it. So, this is Alexander.
Good evening. What time do I end? All right, sounds good. I'm Alexander, and I'm an alcoholic. And there certainly are a lot of you here this evening. You know, it's amazing when Tom called me and said, would you mind doing this? I said, well, sure. Because whenever AA reaches out, I always take the hand because they took mine. And I said, where is it? And he said, at Ridgeview. I said, are you kidding me? Because it's almost 9 years to the day that I was a patient here. But I am not alumni, because Ridgeview joins a long and distinguished list of places that asked me to leave. Just in all transparency. But hopefully, after hearing my story this evening, everybody in this audience that is a patient here or otherwise will use this place, as I should have, as a launching point or a stepping stone to a better and more productive and a healthy life versus the way I did, which was a rung or another stumbling block on my way down to the bottom. And I guess we'll get into that now. Again, my name's Alexander, and I asked for the time because my grandfather, he's a man of many sayings. One of his sayings was that the mind can only absorb what the ass can withstand. So I won't take too much of y'all time. My sobriety date is May 22nd, 2005. My home group is on Monday nights in East Cobb. We meet at my grand sponsor's house. He finished out his basement. Actually, it looks like an AA room. And we do a big book study. Right now, we just switched over to another book, but we take our recovery very seriously. And I believe being a big book thumper, or whatever literature you use, is important, because that's how I got here. And we study it, and we try to maintain our spiritual condition so we can stay sober one day at a time, so we don't get kicked out of any more places. I grew up in East Cobb, not too far from here. As a child, I didn't have really too terrible of an upbringing. I had everything you could ask for, but upon reflection, I realized that I think I was an alcoholic from the very get-go, even before drugs and alcohol entered my system. I can remember even being young, never feeling like I fit in, never feeling like I belonged, always feeling the odd man out, like everybody had the secret to the joke and was laughing, but I didn't know it. And that led into some restlessness and irritability and discontent. In fact, I was 13 years old before I'd even tried drugs or alcohol. When I had my first suicide attempt, I took my dad's gun out to the lake by our house. Obviously, I wasn't successful. I didn't know how to work it. But I can just remember starting out life very unhappy. And my parents were the kind that you had to obey and you sort of lived in fear of, because there was always a switch or a belt or some sort of punishment waiting for you if you got out of line. So somewhere between being crazy and that, I found hopelessness. And that's actually how I ended up here as a patient. I had been arrested, as I was a lot of times. And I've never shared this in a story before, but I figure since I'm back, I'll just completely transparent with y'all. I was sort of at the end of my rope. I had gotten arrested. I had gotten out of jail. And I didn't have a solution. You know, it says in the big book, the lack of power is my dilemma. And I lack power to solve the troubles. So I took a handful of the drugs that I had and a bottle of whiskey and overdosed. And they took me to the hospital right over here. And I'll never forget, the nurse leaned over my bedside and she said, David, that's my first name, and we drew your blood and tested it, and it was lethal. And if you hadn't been here, you wouldn't be here now. And that stuck with me. And they put me in handcuffs the next day and drove me over here. So today I actually came without handcuffs on. Yay! But they took the handcuffs off me and led me into the processing or registration check-in, I guess. And they asked if I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. And I did what any drug addict and alcoholic would do. I said, no, I don't. You know, I'm perfectly fine. You're the problem. And that woman that got me in this position, but it had nothing to do with me. And they took me down to Cottage C, and I was kind of a pain in the ass, and I don't know if anybody's ever gotten Dr. Hush, but I'm not sure if I got the record for Dr. Hush's, but I certainly said it while I was here. The big guys would come out, and they'd be very upset, and they'd hit me with two shots of Thorazine in either hip, and that would be about the end of my, well, I guess you'd call it a temper tantrum at the time. Because I didn't think I belonged. Everybody here had a problem, but I didn't have a problem. My problem was everyone else in my life. My problem was circumstances. My problem was not Alex. My problem was not drugs and alcohol. My problem was everyone else. And I think I deflected that for like the first 20 days I was here. And then I came to a meeting, even because I finally said that I may drink or drugs, so I'll go try these meetings, because I was surrounded by people trying to better themselves. And that sort of laid the seed. It didn't get me sober. Like I said, I raised some more hell. They put me up on the hill. I was in the daycare treatment or day hospital, and right over here, I was in a group meeting. We were sharing our feelings. I don't think they appreciated what I had to say. So I got Dr. Hushed again, and I'll never forget, because I had this favorite black sweatshirt of mine, and when they were dragging me off and sticking me with Thorazine, I said, do I get my black sweatshirt back? And they said, sure. And I never have seen that black sweatshirt again, so they took me back down to Cottage C, and the person from the hill called down and said that we don't want you here anymore. And they waited about a week or two and processed me out, and that was, I guess, about 40 days somehow I lasted here, and didn't recover one bit. I didn't use the tools that were laid at my feet. It was the same story everywhere I went. I just wasn't ready. Like I said, I hope everyone here is ready, because it gets a whole lot better when you take a few simple suggestions. So after leaving here, I was supposed to check into another rehab down where my family had moved by this time, St. Simon's. There was a rehab in Brunswick. As soon as I got clear air, I did what most alcoholics and drug addicts do. I got a hold of some more drugs, and I went and got drunk and overshot the mark again and wrecked my car on the way to rehab. I got to rehab, and they took my blood, and they said, you just got out of rehab. How come you're system's not clean? I said, well, man, I had about 6 hours. I mean, you know, what were you expecting? And I'll tie all that in now. I'll get back to my story. So Eastcom, you know, kind of a sheltered life, private school and such. And I never really had drugs and alcohol as a, my parents didn't drink, you know, they were heavy Christians, and God was, you know, the big angry guy up there, and you know, if you stepped out of line, he was going to whack you. And so they didn't drink or drug because they didn't want to get whacked, and they whacked us to keep God from whacking. There was just a lot of whacking going on. And not in the way you're thinking either. That mind out of the gutter, people. So I was about 17 years old, and I finally got some clear air. My parents said I could go on spring break. I was graduated. I started school early, so I was graduating at 17. So they said, you know, you can go with your friends down to Daytona, Florida. So I went down to Daytona, and I was reveling in the freedom. And I'm not much to look at now, but I can assure you at 17 and 100 pounds, there was not a lot of girls looking my way. But I was determined to find a girl, and my friend and I, we finally coaxed some girls into hanging out with us. And I always like to say I took an emotional hostage, because that's pretty much what I did. And they had an older brother, and he bought us some alcohol, and I had never had a drink, a sip here or there, but never my own drink. And he said, "What do you guys want?" I don't know. I grew up sheltered. And he said, "How about Rumplemints?" It was peppermint schnapps. By that reaction, you know it is not delicious. But at the time, I thought it was delicious. And I took a shot. And for the first time in my life, the world got quiet. For the first time in my life, I wasn't the piece of crap my parents beat down. I wasn't the kid that was picked on anymore. I wasn't smaller. I wasn't inadequate. I was right-sized. It's the way I feel today when I stand in front of y'all. Y'all are my family. Y'all are my like water. You're where I belong. But alcohol was the first place to give me that feeling. And I chased it for many years. And then I took a second shot. And now I wasn't equal to y'all. I was better than y'all. And I was big, you know. And I didn't know it then, but from reading and being in recovery now over 8 years, I learned what happened next. That physical craving, it came on me just like that from my very first drink, and I couldn't stop. So I drank my whole... My whole bottle down, and you know, when that craving's on you, you can't stop. So I then proceeded to start into my friend's bottle, and the girl that I had talked into hanging out with me was very disagreeable with my behavior at this point. And instead of spending a night with a beautiful girl, I ended up throwing up all night and getting sick. So my first drink, I gave up relationship for substance. My first drink, I drank alcoholically. I have no idea what it's like to be a normal drinker. I have no idea what it's like to be a normal drug user. I dabbled into all kinds of drugs, and I never did it normally. You know, one of my favorite speakers says he doesn't know how to do cocaine normally, but I wasn't the one to figure it out, I'll tell you that. And I woke up that next morning, my head hurt. I can remember it to this day. I looked over at my friend. I said, "My God, what did we do? We can never do that again." And we had to head back to Atlanta, and it was 180 degrees like it normally is in Daytona, and I felt like crap. I was covered in my own vomit. And we started heading back to Atlanta, and there was a cooler of beer behind my car, and it was hot because it had been sitting in that Daytona sun. And I reached behind it, and I popped the top, and I drank it. So my second drink was my first morning drink. And that set the style and pace of my alcoholism and my addiction. That's all I knew. I just wanted to check out. I just wanted to escape. I just wanted that feeling of belonging again, and I chased it. And I came back to Atlanta. My parents by this time were going to and from St. Simon's, and they decided to leave me home with my brother to finish out the rest of my senior year in high school. And that was probably not a good idea because he was some bit older than me, so he could provide me with alcohol, and he provided me with other things. And it's amazing to me when I look back at my fourth and fifth step and I look over my life how quickly I descended into alcoholism, how quickly I got sick, how quickly I got to the point where no human power could aid me. You know, it's amazing. It just swallowed me up. Within 2 months of trying my first shot of alcohol, I was shooting heroin. Right after that, I was dropping acid. Right after that, I was selling drugs. And I mean, we're talking months. Before that, clean cut, East Cobb kid, I mean, I wouldn't have even been able to pick a drug out of a lineup. First drink, a couple months later, full-blown drug addict. And that's just the way I am. I know today to live successfully, I have to stay sober and abstinence from everything. I have to be in a spiritual program. I have to have the big book and strict sponsorship. You know, I have to be of service like I am tonight, or I don't have a shot in the dark, and I've proved that to myself. Well, as you can imagine, graduating a Christian high school and enrolled into a Christian college, they did not look too kindly when I got to the college with all my drug paraphernalia and the hoodlums I had brought with me to their pristine Christian campus. So I lasted there. There's again another place I got kicked out of. They asked me to leave. And so I got kicked out of college, and I told my parents, I said, I will do whatever you want me to do. I apologize. You know, I won't ever do it again. And they put me in Bronner, which is a rehab. I don't even know if it's in existence anymore. And I was just a kid. And all of a sudden, I was surrounded by all these older people that had all these wonderful life experiences. And they taught me so much. So I got kicked out of there. And, you know, then came the arrests, and then came the pain, and then came what I thought was the worst moments of my life, you know, and then finally, you know, an arrest. And I was just a kid, so we're looking at, what, about 12 months from my first drink. I'm sitting in Cobb County Jail, where, for the record, I did take periodic vacations to. That's what I used to call them. You know, they would come pick me up, and I'd have my hands behind my back in the car, and I'd be like, take me to my room, please. You know, to the million-dollar palace with round-the-clock security. And I can remember sitting in there, and I was scared. And, I mean, I'm just a kid, and I'm surrounded now not just by people in rehab, but I'm surrounded by criminals that were a lot better at it than I was and a lot bigger and meaner than I was. So I called my parents again, and I said, what do I got to do? You know, get me out of here. And they said, well, if you come home, we ask that you go to church. My parents' solution for everything is you go down to the altar. They're Pentecostal, so a group of people gather around you. They pray over you. They speak in a different language. They put oil on you, and then they declare you healed, and off you go. And that's wonderful if that works for you, but that did not work for me. But to stay out of jail, I played the game. I said, fine. I went down front, and they put oil on me. And to be honest with you, I've had enough oil on me to fry a chicken, and it didn't get me sober. But it did get me off of drugs. You know, if you scared me enough, I could stay off of drugs. But I could never give up the alcohol. That was my best friend. Which was okay, because I got involved in their college and career ministry, and they all drink. They're successful drinkers. They're normal drinkers. So after church, everybody go out and have a beer, or after Bible study, or I'm not quite sure that was the point the pastor was trying to make, but that's what we did. And they would have one or two and go home, and I'd stay there and I would drink. And about this time, I took another emotional hostage. I talked a girl into being my girlfriend, and she was way out of my league. She was really pretty. She was a good girl. She didn't mess with guys like me, but I had convinced her to, you know, good one for me. But that all but destroyed her life, that decision to go out with me on that first date. And I believe her father was trying to communicate that to her, but she didn't listen. And a couple of months after that first date, if you hang out with guys that drink like me and did what I did, she got the first consequence, and she ended up pregnant. And I can remember this to this day. She called me, and I was excited because I thought, you know, I'm in college. At this time, I enrolled here at a community college, and now I've got the girl of my dreams, and she's got a child on the way, my child. You know, now I can be a grown-up, and now I can be what I always saw myself to be, which is like my parents or like normal people with a job and everything else. But unfortunately, if you have alcoholism the way I did, you can't be normal, not without getting help. So we got married, and I tried to stay on the straight and narrow, and I think that lasted about an hour, maybe two. And I can remember this. She would be pregnant and laying in our bed at our apartment, and she asked me to come to bed, and I couldn't get out of my chair because I couldn't stop drinking. I would just sit in my chair in my apartment. It was this awful tweed thing. And I would just drink until I passed out and wake up and do it all over again. And I remember one night I did manage to stumble into the bed, and she was sitting in there praying and crying. And she said, "What's wrong with you?" And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just knew I couldn't be normal. I couldn't stop drinking, and I knew I had to stop. And at this time, I had gotten a job. I think I made like $8 an hour, but to me, I have delusions. I don't know if anybody here relates to that. Like, if I get a job and I make such and such, in my mind, I make such and such, you know. I mean, I'll be there a week and then I run the place, you know. I have delusions of grandeur. You know, they talk about it in the big book. They say that peculiar mental twist. And this fella at work noticed that I was hurting really bad in the morning and smelling. And he said, "Well, why do you do that to yourself?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Why don't you do this?" And then he unrolled a bag of marijuana. And I said, "My God, that's a brilliant idea. I totally forgotten about drugs." Because from that time I sat in Cobb County Jail till about 23, I stayed drug-free. Drunk as a skunk, but drug-free. And I said, "That's brilliant. I can't believe I forgot about that." So I smoked it, and then I smoked his whole bag. And I went home and presented the solution to my drinking problem to my wife, who had now given birth to our beautiful daughter. And I said, "Look, honey, I'm going to quit drinking, just like you asked me to. I'm going to be stoned all the time, but I'm going to quit drinking." And my behavior was so erratic and so abusive on alcohol, she actually bought into the idea. And that lasted, I think the marijuana maintenance program lasted long enough for me to get my college degree, maybe a year or two, but then it wasn't enough. And so I talked to the guy, I said, "Who are you getting this from? Because I need to take over your job because you're not getting nearly enough and you're not getting the right stuff, you know? We got to get this moving." And so I did. I met the guy, and I started getting the drugs that I did as a teenager. The only difference was, as a teenager, it was into oblivion. It was into escape. It was to get away. I would mix everything, looking for the perfect high. By this point, they say this disease is progressive, and I could testify to that, because when I started again down the road, it was addictive. It was one drug, and I would focus totally on that. And at this point, it was cocaine, and it took over everything. It took over my whole life. I became violent around the house, and money became missing. Bills weren't getting paid because nothing could stand in my way between me and getting high. I can remember I had this beautiful, beautiful little girl who just wanted her daddy, but I couldn't touch her because my hands were just covered with cocaine and cigarettes and alcohol. And I didn't want her to touch me because I didn't want her to get sick. And I really, I think, honestly feared that I didn't want her to become me. That's tough. You know, my whole dream, a beautiful wife and a beautiful daughter, and I can't even sit in the same room with them because I can't stay sober long enough to be in the room with them. You know, I didn't deserve that girl that married me, but I definitely didn't deserve the girl that God gave me. And it was about this time my wife got pregnant with our second child, because while you're heading into this end of alcoholism, why not grab some more passengers and throw them on the sinking ship? And I can remember when my son was born, we did it with, what do they call them, midwives, and they asked me to deliver my son. And I was literally so high when I delivered my son. It's a miracle that I did it successfully, but I remember I pulled him out, and here's another great gift from God. But there was a wall between me and that new child, and that wall was drugs and alcohol, and I couldn't get through it to him. So even though I delivered him and had this magical moment, I just passed it right off to my wife and went back to doing what I was doing. I think I went out to the car and got high right there in Kennestone parking lot. And, you know, you can't live that way in poverty and drug addiction and alcoholism without fighting between you and your spouse. I don't care how funny you think you are, she's going to get pissed. And we started to fight. And we started to fight abusively, especially me. And I crossed the line and I became something I never thought I would become. I was always the nice guy, the jokester, the party guy. And now I was a violent drunk that beat his wife and abused his kids. And I was ashamed. And I was locked in that. And we're poor. I can remember my wife opening up the refrigerator to the hotel we were staying in because we couldn't even maintain a place to live. And all we had is jelly. And she took out two plastic spoons and my kids ate jelly. That's all they could afford to eat. And but meanwhile, I had a belly full of booze and a pocket full of drugs. And that shame and that guilt and that remorse, I just had nowhere to go with it. I had no solution. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know why I was acting this way. And then came, as the big book says, the annihilation of all things worthwhile. If I lost everything towards the end. And my wife finally decided she had had enough. By this time, we were able to gather up resources and get a rental house. To me, I thought I had arrived because we had a rental house in East Cobb. And I tore that place apart. And one night, she came home from work. Obviously, I wasn't at work. I missed a lot of days. And she said, "I'm leaving you." And I said, "The hell you are." And I went nuts. And fortunately, she's a very courageous woman. She protected my kids and got them out of the house and called the cops, which should have been done probably a lot earlier. And so this is right before Ridgeview. If you remember, this is a couple weeks before Christmas 2004. Her father had explained to the police that I had a gun. And he may have over-exaggerated my stature because when 4 o'clock in the morning when I was woken up to this sound, David Keene, come lay out in the front yard, you know. And I look out there, and I shit y'all not, they had 2 SWAT teams surrounding my house in full tactical gear. And the funny thing is, my mind... there's that mental twist again. Maybe it was the booze in the belly full of meth. Told me that I think you got him. And so I reached down underneath my bed because I always slept with a shotgun because I'm a classic Southern drunk, you know, a bottle of whiskey and a shotgun by me and no shirt on. I mean, I'm that guy. If you've ever seen Cops, the shirtless guy with the pants and the gun and, hey, man, that was me. So I look out there and I'm like, I think I got him. So I grab my gun and I'm going out there to do battle with 2 SWAT teams. And they got automatic rifles. So I don't think I would have even got one of my pump shotgun off. But in my mind, before I got to the door, here's these delusions again. I don't know how many of y'all have seen this movie, but there's a movie, Young Guns 2, and it's about these guys. And, you know, they're outlaws. And in the very last movie, they all die, but they go out in this blaze of glory. And Bon Jovi is playing this awesome rock song. You know, it's like, shot down in a blaze of glory. Anyways, so that's going through my mind. And I'm like, oh, my God, I am going to be an East Cobb legend. I mean, children are going to be weaned on the greatness of the drug-dealing Alexander when he goes down shooting, you know. And I grabbed the door with that thought in my mind, and then I think this is when God did the first thing for me that I couldn't do for myself. I thought about my wife and kids. You see, drug addiction, alcoholism, I don't know if it made anybody in here, but it made me so self-centered and so self-focused that I never thought of another human being. all I thought about was me. And when I grabbed that door, I thought about them. And I laid the gun down. And I went and laid down, just like they asked me to. And it was a good thing, because there was a lot of them, and I would have lost. And as soon as I laid down, it was about 15 or so seconds, but it was the most professional butt-kicking I've ever gotten in my life. And I've gotten a lot of butt-kickings, but this one, that was a good one. I mean, they hit. I mean, when I came to in the drunk tank the next day, I was black and blue, I mean, from head to toe. And I didn't realize why I was there, so I hit the button, you know, why am I here? And as they started rolling out the charges, you know, terroristic threats, all this other stuff, I was like, what had I done? You know, because I couldn't remember. And as the events came to light, it turns out that after my wife left, I had gone hunting with that shotgun, my family. I had thrown plants through windows into various in-laws' homes, left messages where my father-in-law's house, left horrible messages. And I was in trouble. I mean, I was looking at 15 years or so. And in the tank, they handed me a TPO, a restraining order. I don't know if anybody's familiar with these. I wasn't. I'm not a Perry Mason. But basically, it said, you can't go anywhere near your family. And so in one tragic day in December, I went from having a family, a wife, and two kids that I adored. Within a day, it was all gone. I wasn't allowed to see my wife anymore. I wasn't allowed to see my kids anymore. And we're only a couple of weeks before Christmas. And that's when I got out of jail, when they bailed me out. My dad bailed me out. I went to a hotel over here. And I tried to off myself because I couldn't face it. You know, I was a punk. I was scared. And I couldn't face the consequences. And they brought me here, and we all know that story. I got kicked out, and then I went to the next one, and I got kicked out of there. So I'll bring you up to speed now. After that ride down that I totaled my car to that rehab in St. Simons, after I left there, I went and met the guy again, and I got really high, and I decided that it had been a couple of months, and I had missed Christmas. I needed to write my soon-to-be ex-wife, because she had filed for divorce, a letter. Now, I had a restraining order on me, and you're not allowed to do that, but I didn't really understand that. So I penned what I thought was this beautiful and romantic love letter. And I decided to do what most people do. I went by her house about 3 or 4 in the morning, high on speed, rang the doorbell and dropped it and ran away. The same house that I'd just gotten dragged out of a couple of months earlier. Now, to y'all's shock, that plan did not work. She called the cops, and they read the letter. And they did not find the letter beautiful and romantic and loving. They found the letter pornographic and violent. So they came to arrest me. And they put me in jail. And, you know, I'm so grateful for this, because these offenses, and they were numerous, that they charged me with, are non-bondable offenses. I finally had a fence around me, walls around me. I couldn't break out. You know, I couldn't get out of jail. And like it says in Twice Gifted, in the back of the big book, one of the stories, it said I had to be forced into this life of serenity. I had to be forced into this life of humility. And it goes on to say that she was, the writer of that story, so grateful for those circumstances, because it's what brought them here. And I give you that whole drunk vlog and that whole story to explain to you how I got from sitting in Cottage C almost 9 years ago to standing here. And it was because I got forced into it. I sat in Cobb County for about 40 or 50 days. I can remember when I got there, they said, do you want to call anybody? And I'm like, well, who the hell am I going to call? My parents had disowned me. My brother was scared of me. My wife and kids and her family were in hiding from me. I had nobody to call, so I just took it on the chin, and I decided this is what's best for me. At this time, there is a Christian rehab in Woodstock, and they mainly dealt with fallen pastors and things of that nature. And they decided they wanted to try a real doozy. And they heard there was one in the Cobb County Jail, because a friend of my family's went to the church. And the guy came to get me out. And by this time, I didn't have any front teeth. I had a full mangy beard, and I looked like Ted Kaczynski. My hair was everywhere. And he had to interview me before they let me in their esteemed program. And I can remember I leaned up the plexiglass, and I said, if you can't change me, you know, don't get me out of here, because I'll just hurt you. I'll hurt myself or hurt my family. Because in my mind, my delusional mind, my wife had ratted me out, and she was the cause of all this, you know. And that bitch had to pay. That was my mindset. And so they got me out, amazingly. They went before a judge and said, you can bond him into our custody. We'll take custody of him. And it went about like you think it would, me in a room full of Southern Baptists. It did not go well. For about 8 weeks, I threw pastors around. I'd raised all holy hell. But unlike every other place, the head counselor there, who was actually the director of the ministry, would not kick me out. The counselor that worked with me on a daily basis would go down to his office and be like, it's either him or me. So, and you got to get this guy out of here. And the other counselor, he wouldn't kick me out. And I remember I would go into his office for counseling, and I would raise hell. And he would just sit there and look at me, and he would just push this cross at me and didn't say anything for 8 weeks. Just push this cross at me. That's all he did, 8 weeks. And I'm like, what the hell is wrong with this guy? I can't break him. I mean, I'm hitting every button, you know what I mean? And it's not working. Why aren't you kicking me out, you know? And finally, on April 12th, 2005, which is not my sobriety date, we're in a meeting. And I came to one of those spiritual moments in your life, like Bill's when he was standing in front of the church in the beginning of the big book. And I realized what I needed. I needed a God. And the God of my understanding, I met that day. I ran down to Roy, that's my counselor's office. There was another guy on the couch. Remember, I'm consumed with self. I threw him off the couch. And I fell on my knees, and I accepted Jesus right then and there. And I just cried and snot bubbles, and it was like something out of the movie. He got the holy water and was splashing it on me. And if I was a pastor, I'd splash me with holy water too. And I never experienced that because my family is Pentecostal. They are mainly oil-based religion. This is a water-based religion. And the Baptists, they're excited about damn water. They were ready to get me baptized right then. And I said, you know, that's fine. And I did. And things began to change. And now I had a God. But you see, if I have a God and no program, I'm screwed. If I have a program and no God, I'm equally screwed. I've got to have a God actively working in my life through a program, or I'm a shark out of water, you know, and I'm dead. And that's what I had. I had a God and no program. And I graduated their program, but it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous, so it didn't work. And the night before my baptism, because they wanted to get me baptized, I had about 12 hours to kill, so I thought I'd celebrate my newfound Christianity and getting baptized by going to get a beer with a girl that I had met here that wasn't my wife. And that went about like you thought it would. I found out very quickly that I wasn't just a drug addict, that I was an alcoholic, because I set out to have a beer, and I think I came to at 6 o'clock in the morning in bed with somebody that wasn't my wife. So the night before my baptism, I celebrated by breaking pretty much all the Ten Commandments. I'm surprised the water didn't boil when I went in. And I was scared. Because I was like, what's wrong? You know, I did everything this one place told me to do, and I found Jesus, but I'm still drinking. And I hid. I hid in my house. And I won't go into it because I want to get to the rest of the story. I met my sponsor through a set of circumstances, and he took me to not my first meeting, but I call it my first meeting in sobriety. And after that meeting, he said, can I be your sponsor? And I said, sure. So the day after my baptism, May 22nd, 2005, is my sobriety date. I have not had a drink or a drug since then. That's a miracle. That's God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. But I'm a troublemaker, and I didn't take all the suggestions like he suggested. I worked the steps, and I did them my way. You know, I was a liar, and so when I did the fourth step, I just started making shit up. You know, I was like, I'll make this sound good, but I don't want you to know me, because you know, if you know me, you'll reject me. You'll kick me out. You know, Ridgeview, you know, everywhere, my high school, everywhere has kicked me out. So I hid, because AA was the only place that hadn't kicked me out, and I was afraid they were going to. Turns out they don't kick anybody out, but I didn't know that. And so I worked the program, I got through all the steps, and I stayed sober, but I was basically a loaded gun for God, you know. I contacted my soon-to-be ex-wife as soon as the restraining order went down, completely took her inventory, let her know that Jesus didn't approve of divorce, and she had to get home, and she needed to submit to my will, and I knew what our plan was, and she didn't like that. And so I spent from 2005 to 2007 trying to convince this woman that I had given up other women, alcohol, and drugs, and she needed to submit to God's will and be married to me. And I came to a point in February of 2007. I can remember I was at the circus with my kids, because this time I could be a single dad. So if you're a single parent, I got sober single parenting as a father. I never missed a child support payment. I never missed a day with my children. I was there on time every time. So if you are a single parent with two, my kids were basically toddlers at the time, you can get sober. I did. I used to drag them to meetings with me. But I had taken them to the circus, and I said, God, you know, just show me why I'm not going home. It should have been apparent, but I wanted to know. So I went to drop my kids off at my wife's house, and I met one of the reasons why I wasn't coming home. She had found a fella. Now, that probably would have been an expected outcome to most people, but I have a delusion and a mental twist. I thought I was going home. I thought if I stayed sober and I went to church and I parted my hair and I got baptized and I quit womanizing and drinking and drugging, I'd get to go home. And my whole program was built on that. It wasn't built on the steps. It was built on delusion and denial. And that delusion and denial came to a screeching halt. And I called my sponsor, which is amazing, because this is the first time in my life that something bad had happened that I didn't make it worse. I called my sponsor and I said, buddy, she's in the house with another dude. And his response was, oh, shit. He said, are they still alive? And I said, yes. I said, yes. He said, is there anything on fire? And I said, no, because a couple of years ago when I got kicked out of my house, I burned all her clothes on the way out because, you know, you don't get one on me. I'll show you. And then a few years later, acting surprised, she didn't want to get back together with me. Because I forgot. I have a great forgetter. I forget about the pain of the drinking. I forget about the pain of the circumstances. And I said, well, what do I do? And he said, get in your car and go. And I pulled in out of the driveway 4 or 5, maybe 16 times. But I did. I pulled out of the car. And now I am into where this big book talks about resentments. And I am eat up with it. I've never had one. I guess I did, but I was able to numb it out. But now I had one, and I'm sober. And if you've ever had resentment and you're sober, it's a scary place because you're screwed. Because that mental obsession that thought so much about drugs and alcohol has now got a new bone to hunt, and it is hunting, you know. And I tore her apart emotionally. I tore everyone around me emotionally with that resentment. I mean, if you went to a meeting with me back then, all you heard was the great mental twist in my little story. This woman had betrayed and abandoned me. Now she's cheated on me, you know. And on the third day, I'll rise again, you know, because I'm Jesus and I'm the martyr. I'm staying sober and she's running around on me, you know. And I ran this story and I was throwing up. That's how upset I was. I signed the divorce papers because obviously That's way too many people to be in a marriage, and it was already on its last leg anyway. So I signed the divorce papers, and I just went around and said the game. Here I am. I'm Jesus. I got sober. I straightened up, and this woman's off. And then, and it came to fall 2007. I went to The Rock. I don't know how many guys go to The Rock, but I do. I don't know how to get sober without The Rock, and I don't know how to stay sober without it. Everything I have is revolved around The Rock. And they had a speaker there, that one I referenced earlier. He's even spoken here. I'm kind of amazed to stand where he stood. And he's a doctor, and he explained my disease perfectly. And for the first time in AA, I actually took the cotton out of my ears and I heard my story. And he laid out the solution. He talked about the Joe and Charlie tapes, and he talked about the freedom that I wasn't experiencing. And so I came back to Atlanta. I sat in my cube. I've never done anything the right way. I downloaded the Joe and Charlie tapes at work, put the headphones on, and I began to listen to the solution. And I began to cry. And this time, I took the steps the way they're supposed to. You know, in step one, I finally conceded to my innermost self, I got this. I am an alcoholic. I am a drug addict. I'm not just a guy trying to overcome the consequences of somebody else's behavior. I'm trying to overcome a disease I have. And in step two, I came to believe that God could restore me to sanity. I believed that the day after that incident where I found my wife with that guy because I didn't drink. I didn't drug. I woke up the next morning and I called my sponsor. He said, are you sober? I said, yes. And he said, that's a miracle. And I said, you're right. So the day after finding out some horrible news, I'm crying not because I lost my wife. I'm crying because I'm sober. And I didn't hurt the guy or myself or my wife. And that was a huge step. And I said, there has to be a God. Only God could have done that for me. And I turned my will and my life over to God. And this time when I hit my knees, I let it all go. It wasn't just a decision anymore. I gave it to him. This is your show, buddy. You've given me this wonderful life, and I've thrown it back in your face. This beautiful woman gave me 4 or 5 years of her life, and I destroyed hers in return. I've destroyed these two kids' life. I couldn't even reconcile. You know, I've tried everything on Alex's will. Everything on Alex's will, and it's gotten me nada. So I said, you take it, God. It's your show. And this time when I went into step four, you see, the first time, besides all the other stuff I made up, when I took the fourth step, I never got to the last column, which is, what is your part? I only got to the first part, which just talked about what my wife had done to me, what my daddy had done to me, what all the whining that goes with it. But this time, and I'll use my wife as an example, I did the fourth column. You know, I wrote the truth. And the truth was, my wife hadn't betrayed and abandoned me. The truth is, my wife's a hero, and she protected her kids, and she left me because I was drunk, and I deserved it. And anybody in their right mind would have left, and probably left earlier. You know, I admitted that. And I admitted, like I said earlier, that I abused her. First to myself, then to God, and another human being. Just like it says in step five. And the weights and the scales and the freedom that everybody talked about had come to me finally. And I felt that resentment ease and pass. And I went into step six and seven, and I had just breezed through that. I don't even know how I missed it the first go round. And I realized the glaring character defects that were in my life. And I became willing for the first time in my life to change. You see, when I came in the program, I always tell people I had a personality like a porcupine on speed, you know what I mean? I was just an asshole, and I poked and prodded into everybody and everything, and I was tired of that. You know, I was sold that I had to stay sober, so I asked God to begin removing those character defects, and one of the first things he removed was that anger and that mouth and that abuse and that violence. He removed that. And I'm so grateful, and I'm sure my ex-wife was, because she stopped getting 400 texts a day, you know, letting her know what was wrong with her. I was just trying to help. And I went into step 8 and 9. You see, the first time I went through amends, basically I just went around and told everybody what they had done to me and they should feel sorry for me. That does not work, by the way. This time I went in, and as altruistically as I can on this side of heaven, I went into 8 and 9 because I wanted to set wrong the right. You see, when I took step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 the way you're supposed to, you know, I became painfully aware of the pain I had caused. I became aware of the roaring tornado going through other people's life. I became aware of the damage I had caused, and it sat on me, not in, you know, remorse or in painfully wandering around like it talks about in here, but I wanted to take action and more action. So I went around and I set the account right. In the child support, I started including a little extra money to buy her some new clothes, one of many amends that I made. And I went into step 10, and my sponsor's big on the 12 and 12, step 10. I don't know how I missed it, but now I do. I draw up an account at night. Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I this? And it's amazing to me, none of this had to do with drugs and alcohol. This just had to do with that personality like a porcupine on speed. And I began to change. And I went in step 11 in prayer and meditate, seeking God. And I wanted to know the God that had done this miracle in my life, because as I looked around the disaster of the divorce and legal consequences, I was like, holy crap, I've been sober going on 3 years. Wow. And I began to appreciate that gift, and I began to seek after God. You know, it says, seek him and you will find him. And I did. And it says in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, after working the steps the way they're supposed to, I had had a spiritual awakening. When I first came in the rooms, I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't want to know anybody. Ironic, I stand up here today because I still go to meetings at clubhouses, and I don't say anything, not too often. But I hid in the back of the room, and when people came up to talk to me, I ran because I was scared. I didn't know how to communicate with people. But after working the steps and having a personality change, because if you look at what a spiritual awakening is in the back of the book, it says having a personality change sufficient enough to bring about recovery. Having had this personality change, I began to come out of my shell. I began to relate to people. I began to look you in the eye. I became okay with me. One of the greatest gifts Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is it gave me the gift of me. And I began to change. And it was about this time, we're in 2009, that my ex-wife called me. And because she hadn't really heard from me in about a year, because I wasn't pissed off anymore, you know. I was just reveling in the joy of sobriety, the pink cloud experience. And she said, would you mind if we put our son in baseball? Because he hadn't been able to play sports before because of me. And I asked my sponsor, I said, is this a good idea? And he said, yeah, I think it's time you show her you. And I said, okay, let's put him in baseball. And we began to sit next to each other at baseball games. A little awkward at first with your in-laws that you had tossed potted plants through the windows and terrorized for 5 years. But they began to laugh, and they began to joke with me. And then my wife began to laugh. My ex-wife began to laugh and to joke with me. And they're like, who is this guy? And she invited me to church with her. And so I showed up on Sunday and I went to church with her. And this time, unlike when we were married before, I didn't smell like booze and drugs. I was sober and I was participating. And they didn't try to put any oil or water on me. So that was good. And I said, well, why don't I take you guys out to dinner? You know? And wow, because she had never, you know, seen any of this from me before. And after the practices, I would take her and the kids out to dinner. And you guys had taken a boy, because I came in when I was 29. About this time, I was 34. You guys had taken a boy and made him into a man. I opened doors for her. I combed my hair. I sat at the table, pulled her chair out, paid the bill, didn't call her any names. And And that was it. And we started doing that for a couple of months. And then I finally gathered up the strength. And I said, well, what would you think if we went out to dinner, just you and I? And she said, well, okay. So we began to go out on a date. And I held her hand and opened the door. And this obviously freaked her out because she's like, who is this guy? You see, we have a program of attraction. I tried for 5 years on Alex's will to force my family back together, and I couldn't do it. I finally let go and surrendered. It's the great miracle of surrender. It's the paradox. I finally surrendered and gave up my dream of getting my family back together, and here I am sitting eating dinner with her. But I wasn't really interested in what most guys are interested in when they're out to dinner with a girl. I wasn't interested in just getting into her pants or anything else. I was actually interested in setting the wrong I had done right. It didn't even dawn on me that there was anything romantic. I just wanted to be the guy that didn't fail her. I wanted to show her that she was worth more than the way she was treated in the past. You know, I wanted to set the account right. Apparently, women find that attractive. Because on June 26th, after being apart almost 6 years, she sent me a text. And she said, I'm coming home. I had tried in drugs and alcohol to give her a home, but I couldn't because I was too sick. And then early sobriety, I was too pissed. You know, it's a funny thing about forgiveness. I was at a meeting, and I was smoking a cigarette, and there was this thing about some Christian movie where a couple gets back together. And I remember I flung the magazine away, and I said, oh, yeah, did you cheat on you and divorce you, and you stay sober for no damn reason. And I walked outside, and I was smoking my cigarette, and it's almost like God hit a play button in my mind, and I saw everything I'd ever done to every other human being, including myself. And I just felt inside of me, if I can forgive you for that, you can't forgive her for this. And, you know, I did forgive her, and I forgave myself, and it brought us to that moment in June 26 where she said she was coming home. She felt safe enough too, and it was my weekend with the children, so she came home on a Friday night, and the kids had already gone to bed. And when they woke up Saturday morning, my son would always come get in bed with us. And, or me at that time, he came to get in bed. And he was so young when I left, or was kicked out. He had never seen his parents together. And he walked in the room and he said, good morning, Dad. And I said, good morning. And his mom sat up. And he goes, Mom? And she said, good morning, buddy. And the power of that one moment will stay with me forever, because our son finally saw what this program was about. There is nothing that is more powerful than the God in this. And for the first time in his life, he saw his mom and together, and they were whole and healthy and sober and happy. There was no more holes in the wall. There was no more drugs. There was no more alcohol. There was just the family afterward it talks about in the big book. And he jumped in bed and he felt both his parents holding for the first time in his life. And that's a miracle. You see, when I came in here, I was homeless. And now I own a home. My family was broken. And now it's whole. More importantly, I was drunk and sober. And I had gotten kicked out of Ridgeview. And now I'm sober and I'm alive. And I know if I can do it, you know, you can do it. And if I can come through all those circumstances and stay sober, anybody can. And I'll end with this, because I don't want your guys' asses to give out on me here, because I know I've taken a little longer. But I love this little bit, and I was reading it today before I came up here. And I'll just read the last paragraph from A Vision for You. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God, and admit your faults to Him and to your fellows, and clear away the wreckage of your past, and give freely of what you find, and join us. And we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. And may God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you guys for letting me tell my story.
That's one more reason I am so happy that I'm in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I get to see that miraculous transformation happen over and over again. So, Alexander, thank you once again. That was just wonderful. Thank you.